has already purchased Israeli-built drone technology to track illegal entry attempts, with further purchases on the horizon.
It's been battle tested, proven how it works in Gaza. So the same technology which is used to harass and surveil Palestinians. The UK are not only hosting outlet sites to produce these drones, but they're actually making contracts to buy these very same drones in order to surveil the channel to stop migrants and refugees from seeking safety in this country. If you see someone about to be hurt, most people would step in the way. And that applies when we know that these weapons being produced here will be used to kill other people who, in a lot of circumstances, are powerless to what that weapon can do.
Both France and the United Nations have expressed grave concern at the UK's new tactics, which they feel could lead to many needless drownings in the English Channel, while Israel's arms industry is providing Britain the tools it needs in order to hunt down these vulnerable vessels. That's just another reason why Palestine Action feels so determined to see Elbit shut down. Robert Carter, Leicester.
After some 13 months of a deadlock in the country and a descending multifaceted crisis, Lebanon saw the birth of a new cabinet led by Najib Miqati. Miqati stressed that he will do everything in his power to stop Lebanon's collapse.
The situation is difficult but not impossible to deal with if we cooperate together as Lebanese. We need to work hand in hand. Today the president and I work on forming this cabinet and it is not perfect, but only God is perfect. I can assure you that we are a team and we will work as one until we stop all the despair. I will leave at nothing to contact all international organizations to try to provide the minimum of good living and at least stop the collapse.
Lebanon's new prime minister urged the political groups to cooperate and give this government confidence to work as a team. President Michelon told reporters off camera that the new government will begin addressing the concerns of the Lebanese, adding that Lebanon will get out of hell and rise from the abyss. A lineup of 24 ministers was announced on Friday from the Lebanese presidential palace.
The challenges this cabinet faces are economic, financial, monetary, and social. Therefore, it needs to hurry in putting together a salvation plan. This plan should include short-term objectives and finding quick solutions, since this cabinet has only an 8-month term and therefore cannot put long-term plans. This is possible either through talks with the International Monetary Fund or through implementing the reform plan, which was endorsed by the French initiative.
With the government now formed, the Lebanese parliament will soon convene to issue a vote of confidence for the Miqati government. After a little over 1 month, Prime Minister Najib Miqati has finally managed to form a cabinet in accordance with President Michelon. However, the various challenges that lie ahead with regards to the socioeconomic and the financial crisis are far from over. Maryam Saleh from Baabda's presidential palace.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Recent research revealed that British-made military components and hardware were used by Israeli regime forces during recent airstrikes on Gaza, in spite of government claims about Britain's tough arms export controls. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Rafif Ziada, a lecturer in Comparative Politics of West Asia at SOAS University of London, titled British Backing for Israel Helps to Sustain the Unbearable Status Quo. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. Rafif Ziada wrote, "I often tell my first-year politics students that the study of politics is the study of power. And what we saw recently, above all, was the glaring disparity in power between Israeli regime and the Palestinians. When Palestinians in Gaza and around the world celebrated the news of a ceasefire, breathing a sigh of relief, many commentators hailed it as a return to calm. However, for Palestinians, calm means a status quo of occupation, blockade, and repression. In fact, one can say the true nature of this conflict is what happens between the periodic escalations, the constant grind of life under apartheid. Israeli regime power over the Palestinians is not simply military, and it is not only maintained by force, it is sustained by international support. The significance of this support becomes obvious during Israeli regime military offensives. Recently, the U.S. willfully obstructed a U.N. Security Council statement on Gaza to buy more time for the Zionist regime's bombing campaign. But the key elements of this international support are consistent. The most substantial diplomatic and financial support comes from the U.S. $3.8 billion annually, most of which is in military aid and circulates back to the U.S. arms industry. International government support for the regime of Israel has continued even as the Israeli regime political and military leaders have been accused of serious violations of international law and the illegal use of force, abuses serious enough to warrant an international criminal court investigation. The UK has also given the Zionist regime its full backing, while Britain has a particular legacy in the conflict. As a former colonial power in historical Palestine, support continues today with a thriving arms trade between the two regimes. Approved export licenses for arms sales from the UK to the Zionist regime cover components for small arms, ammunition, night sight technology, and intelligence. The UK also imports Israeli regime-made weapons. For example, in 2016, the Zionist regime's major arms producer, Elbit, in conjunction with Thales UK, completed delivery on most of the 54 Watchkeeper drones as part of an £800 million contract. Between 2018 and 2020, the British Ministry of Defence bought 46 million pounds worth of military equipment from Elbit. Such weapons are marketed as battle-tested, demonstrating the ways that day-to-day violence against Palestinians spurs a profitable industry with international reach. Recent research revealed that British-made military components and hardware were used by Israeli regime forces during recent airstrikes on Gaza. In spite of government claims about Britain's tough arms export controls, the Israeli regime F-35 warplanes that are used to bomb the densely populated territory have component parts from a host of UK suppliers, including BAE Systems, GE Aviation, Martin Baker, Selex, Cobham, Ultra Electronics, UTC Actuation Systems, and Rolls-Royce.
According to Campaign Against Arms Trade, between 2016 and 2020, the UK issued single individual export licenses for arms sales to the occupied Palestinian lands to a value of £400 million. This is a significant increase from £67 million in licenses from 2011 to 2015. Last month, in Leicester, campaigners occupied the rooftop of UAV Tactical Systems, a subsidiary of Elbit Systems. Elbit Systems UK has 9 production sites and offices in the country. The Leicester facility manufactures the Hermes drone that has been used by the Zionist regime military in Gaza. Campaigners managed to disrupt production for several days before another protest started against an Elbit factory in Oldham. These actions highlight just how much Britain is entwined with the Zionist regime's military power within innocuous buildings hidden in industrial estates in England. One of the Zionist regime's major private weapons firms operates freely, with no consequences for how its weapons are used in Palestine or elsewhere. Essential British company JCB, which makes bulldozers, was one of the 3 British firms listed by the UN as complicit in the construction of illegal settlements and demolition of Palestinian homes. JCB is currently being examined by the UK government to determine whether its due diligence process complies with human rights guidelines set by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. While the Zionist regime portrays itself as a small regime simply acting in self-defense, in reality it is carrying out a decades-long military occupation, denying Palestinian refugees the right to return and continuing to displace hundreds of families. It has one of the most equipped militaries in the world, aided and abetted by the backing of international powers. This is why Palestinians have appeal to people of conscience around the world to protest against such blatant complicity with the Zionist regime's violations of human rights and international law. British-based organizations such as War on Want and Campaign Against Arms Trade have called for an end to military exports to the occupied lands and a review of UK arms sales. This is an important step in challenging the unequivocal support the Zionist regime receives in military aid while it continues to violate Palestinian rights daily. When MP Zora Sultana held up pictures of Palestinian children martyred during the latest assault on Gaza and directly asked Boris Johnson if UK-made weapons were used in the bombardment of Gaza, he did not deny it. But he quickly deflected the question with a string of platitudes about Britain's support for a two-state solution. Endless lip service to the two-state solution rings hollow as the US, UK, and EU assist the fake regime of Israel in creating facts on the ground that have made it functionally impossible, including ongoing illegal settlement construction, land confiscation, displacement, restrictions on Palestinian movement, and the incarceration of thousands of Palestinians. Hiding behind the smokescreen of quiet diplomacy, these states continuously undermine Palestinian attempts to hold the Zionist regime to account. For example, Boris Johnson has opposed the International Criminal Court inquiry into atrocities committed in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Al-Quds. In the face of this, Palestinians can only point out the hypocrisy as they continue to protest. The general strike called on May 18th by all Palestinians was a heartening moment of unity, breaking the barriers imposed by military checkpoints and walls. Palestinians also rely on the power of ordinary people around the world, willing to speak out and challenge the complicity of their own governments in maintaining this conflict. The demonstrations around the world, across many capitals and small towns, and the statements of solidarity by trade unions, artists, and academics attest to the fact that more and more people are coming to understand the status quo is untenable. Some may choose to avert their eyes after Gaza, Al-Quds, and West Bank are no longer dominating the headlines, but Palestinians do not have that option. Ending the arms trade with the Israeli regime is a crucial step for unmasking the illusion of calm that obscures the ongoing oppression of Palestinians, and for honestly confronting Britain's role in maintaining this brutal status quo.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. Iran's foreign ministry says the interim government, Iran's foreign ministry has actually had a reaction to what the IAEA has said in terms of the interim agreement that it has reached. This came based on the fact that Iran, given the fact that it's an MPT member, it did not pose, obviously, any type of endangerment. However, based on the cooperation that Iran has given, there was an interim agreement that was reached. But it has not only been a victim of nuclear deal gone wrong due to the U.S. pullout. The Israeli regime, the possessor of nuclear warheads, though undeclared, accuses it of racing to get the bomb. Let me bring in our correspondent, Homolesky, from Vienna first to find out how this interim agreement came into place. Homo, at this point, tell us more, if you can, elaborate more on what happened.
Yes, Pavel. Today, of course, we had the beginning of the IAEA Board of Governors session, and today Rafael Mariano Grossi informed the board and issued a separate report describing to them what happened in Iran, saying that during his visit that took only a few hours, I think 10 hours in all when he was in Tehran, he'd reached an arrangement with Iran that allows the agency to continue monitoring and verifying Iran's activities. So basically what this means is that the IAEA's monitoring equipment, the cameras, the surveillance equipment are still going to be recording the data. However, this data, as I said before, is going to remain in Iran under the joint seals of Iran and the IAEA. And he said that this is basically a stopgap measure, or this is an effort to create a bridge between now and the time when the JCPOA will hopefully be back in place. But if the talks to resume the JCPOA do not lead anywhere, if we don't have a JCPOA in place, then what will happen? This is something that the sides have not actually discussed yet, and they're waiting to see how developments evolve from this stage on. If indeed the JCPOA does not survive, this means that the agency will not have any of the access that it had under the JCPOA, and Iran has said before, at least under the previous government, that it will keep this data or destroy this data and not give this data to the agency. So what the agency wants at this stage is to be able to have a continuity of knowledge when it comes to Iran's activities. So in the case that the JCPOA is back in place, it can reconstruct the picture of Iran's activities. And I also noticed that you were referring there to the issue of Israel. I'd also like to just quickly mention here that, in fact, today in the press conference, there was a question put to Mr. Grossi concerning actions against Iran's nuclear program, sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, for instance, in a facility in the city of Karaj, or the assassination of Iranian scientists. And we know that a lot of media reports have said that this is the work of the Israeli regime. One of the reporters is asking Mr. Grossi if he is going to condemn these kinds of attacks that are being perpetrated against the nuclear facilities of an IAEA member state that is under IAEA supervision. And he still did not mention Israel, just saying in very broad terms that the agency as an international organization condemns all acts of violence. And this is something that Iran, the Iranian ambassador here, has time and again talked about in his addresses to the board, saying that the agency has a duty to officially and systematically condemn Israel for its sabotage attacks against the Iranian nuclear facilities, and also complain and about the fact that Israel is not an MPT member state, is not actually a part of the MPT, does not have any obligations, while it has nuclear weapons and is considered a threat in the Middle East. The agency refuses to even discuss this issue or to try and persuade the Israeli regime to accept some of these commitments. So it does have a nuclear weapons program on the one side, and on the other side, as a nuclear weapons power in the Middle East, it does not have any restrictions. It does not have to report to the IAEA about its activities, and it's actually being rewarded. So this is also a position that's been expressed time and again by the Iranian ambassador here.
Thank you very much for that, Homolesky. We appreciate it. Homolesky there from Vienna. Let me introduce our guest, writer and political analyst John White, joins us from Edinburgh. John White, welcome.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Actually, Daniel Lazar also joins us. And at this point, we're going to have John White to get the first question. John White, you know, when we take a look at this, you take a look at this interim agreement that was announced between the IAEA and Iran. It's a temporary agreement, but at the same time, Iran, looking at the situation where the U.S. pulled out of a deal, and Iran, that's an MPT member, allowing the IAEA, obviously, inspections, one of the strictest inspection regimes that the IAEA has had on any country, comes out and makes this deal together. Why is it that Iran is being accused and portrayed in a negative light when it comes to the way that it's conducted itself, and yet the cooperation is not reflected in this?
Well, thanks for having me. This is IAEA to continue monitoring its nuclear activities and its development of its nuclear energy, given where we are, that the Americans sabotaged the JCPOA under the Trump administration, given that Iran, as your correspondent eloquently laid out, is not a member of the MPT, the Non-Proliferation the treaty, but that it has something in the region of 300 nuclear warheads developed with the connivance and the aid of the West, Western powers, and it gives lie to the fatuous claim of Western ideologues that the West stands for the rules-based international order and international law, and countries like Iran are rogue states, when in fact it's the absolute opposite which is true, which is Israel is given sanction by the West to behave like a rogue state, and Iran is a victim of the West's hypocrisy. This is grotesque hypocrisy, which yet again confirms that the problem that ails our world is not a lack of democracy within states, but a lack of democracy between states.
All right, let's bring in at this point Daniel Lazar from New York. He's a journalist and author. Daniel Lazar, welcome. There might be some viewers out there who are not familiar with, for example, what the NPT is. If you don't mind, generally speaking, explaining to us what that is, and at the same time, tell us why isn't Israel a member of the NPT, if you can.
The Non-Proliferation Treaty was an agreement. I forget when it was negotiated, but it was part of a deal that would allow the core nuclear states to hold onto their weapons. And in return for no new states coming on board, attaining nuclear capability, the core nuclear states agreed to work towards a mutual disarmament of their own nuclear weapons. So there was a tit for tat. There was a disarmament among the core nuclear states and an agreement among the non-nuclear states not to try to attain nuclear status. So the grand strategy was to therefore deliberately, carefully, gradually ratchet down the international nuclear arms race. And Israel, thanks to the U.S., was granted a giant exception. It was allowed to accumulate nuclear weapons with no international oversight, and it's not a member of the NPT. So therefore, it claims the right to go it alone. And in fact, when the UN Security Council gave its blessings to the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord with Iran, the resolution actually included a plank that said there would be no reference, no criticism of Israel's anomalous status. It didn't quite say that outright, but that was clearly implicit in the language of the resolution. And the JCPOA and Iran, in agreeing to the JCPOA, tacitly agreed to this anomalous status on the part of Israel. So Iran's rough treatment by the U.S. ever since 2018, when Donald Trump walked out of the JCPOA for no good reason, even though the international authorities agreed that Iran was faithfully abiding by the terms of the agreement. So since then, Iran has sort of suffered a double rebuff. It's been punished for both abiding by the terms of the JCPOA and also by tacitly agreeing to the continuation of Israel's anomalous status. And so for those concessions, Iran has gotten a great big fist in its face, delivered by the United States. It's really a complete outrage.
Indeed, there was a presser that Said Khatibzadeh, John White, the foreign ministry spokesperson, when asked a question as to why the International Atomic Energy Agency and European countries show no sensitivity towards non-peaceful nuclear program of Israel. This was his response. Unfortunately, the West follows a double and very shameful standard, as a result of which it not only refrains from putting pressure on Israel to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and to disarm, but also provides it with everything at its disposal, that is, to encourage it to violate the international system and pose a permanent threat to the region and the world. His words, do you agree with it?
Absolutely, in every particular. The only thing I would say with double standard is putting it lightly. This is a crime. Because it's a crime of the threat of nuclear mushroom hanging over Iran, hanging over other countries that refuse to bow to the West and bow to Israel as a Western ally in the region. And the fact that Israel is allowed to continue to stockpile something in the region, as I said earlier, 300 warheads. That's a dagger pointed at the heart of Iran. That's a dagger pointed at the heart of Iran. And no government that's self-right-thinking can allow that dagger to continue to point at its heart. That's a viable security threat on a daily basis. And that's something that the Iranian government must take seriously. There is no restraint on Israel. There's no constraints by which it abides. It has the West dangling by a string over residual guilt over the Holocaust. That's what this is all about. All roads lead to the Holocaust when it comes to Israel being allowed to arrogate this power to itself, its exceptionalist status. But guess what? The Iranians were not responsible for the Holocaust, which killed 6 million Jews in Europe. Neither were the Palestinians. Neither was the Arab and Muslim world entire. Yet they're having to pay the price. And it's a long time that the West was held up to account and that Israel was held to the same standard that the Iranians are being held to. Iran's been nailed on the cross of Western guilt over the Holocaust, and it's a grotesque hypocrisy.
We're going to break this open a little bit, but let's go for a flashback here, Daniel Lazar, if I may, and see if you remember who said the following. Tehran will be on the brink of a nuclear weapon in less than a year. Iran is 90% along the path of having sufficient weapons-grade material. And the person who said this had something in his hand that was in the form of a caricature drawing. Do you recall who that person is?
Yes, I do. I do. That was Benjamin Netanyahu in his famous speech before the U.N. General Assembly.
And what year was it? Do you remember?
Pardon me? Yeah, and he held up a crude drawing of a nuclear bomb. It was really a comical performance. But the funny thing is that not only does Israel revel in its nuclear monopoly in the Middle East, but it regularly threatens violence against Iran for doing anything, making the slightest sign of challenging that monopoly. And now that the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord, to me it's clearly a dead letter. But now that it's a dead letter, I think that Israel is more prone to take military action against Iran, and for the chances of some kind of military conflict in the Persian Gulf are rising significantly.
The problem here, and I bring this up, John White, I mean, this is first of all going back to 9 years ago, but how is it that Israel is taken seriously when its credibility is in question? Time and again, Netanyahu has said, I'm disclosing these secrets about Iran's weaponization of nuclear program or whatever terminologies he uses. And the IAEA has, in some cases, actually said, we have new information coming from Israel. We have to look at it. We have to analyze it. And my point being is, why is it that then, when Israel has come out and said these falsifications, that is still being taken seriously?
Well, Israel is seen as a strategic asset by the West, particularly the United States and the region, even though it's actually a liability, and it's increasingly become so. You mentioned the Benjamin Netanyahu circus at the UN General Assembly. I think it may have been 2014. I think it was during the Obama administration where he was trying to bounce Obama into not going forward with the JCPOA at that time. But Israel is taken seriously by Western governments, but it's not taken seriously increasingly by Western populations. Support for the Palestinians, for example, has never been higher in the West. Anytime there's another bout of Israeli violence against the Palestinians in Gaza, the demonstrations are bigger than they've ever been before. I think it's commonly held, the consensus is among people of conscience and consciousness in the West, that Israel is a rogue state, is an apartheid state, and is a serial violator of international law. So this is a real geopolitical disjuncture that exists in the West now between what the governments want and what they think is in their interest and the populations at large who are appalled at support for this rogue state, which is an oppressor of the Palestinians, which does not abide by international law, and which sees itself enjoying an exalted status because of the support it receives from capitals, Washington, London, Paris, and Bonn, etc.
Yeah, and what happens, Daniel Lazar, is you're having Naftali Bennett, for example, coming out recently, fresh out of his trip from the White House, saying there needs to be a rapid international action against Iran's enrichment surge. Or you have Israel's Minister for Military Affairs just days ago threatening Iran, prepared to strike Iran, he said. Even the U.S. President Joe Biden recently said there are options. You know, that famous use that word, quote, options on Iran. And here it is, you know, making these threats against Iran. When Iran is cooperating with IAEA, and the most recent cooperation is what happened with the interim agreement reached the Iran, again, with the IAEA in terms of what are monitoring arrangements that they made. Again, Iran showing goodwill. So you can see where I'm going with this. Again, yeah. Why is it that Iran is being shown as the bad guy?
Because Iran is being set up for a mugging. I mean, essentially, Israel is very consciously pushing Iran into a corner where whatever it does is wrong, and whatever it does, therefore, merits an ever more militaristic response by Israel. So it's being set up for some kind of assault. We don't know when it's going to happen. You know, the timing is indecipherable. But clearly, Israel thinks it has Iran checkmated. And that it over some point, you know, it'll continually press its advantage and therefore use its military leverage and economic leverage to really push Iran more and more into a corner.
Okay, John White, a recommendation that came from one of the administrations of Iran, which is still something that Iran holds out there for it to be done, and that is the recommendation of a Middle East region, which we refer to as the West Asia region, to be free of nuclear weapons. I mean, this is something that Iran wants to actively pursue, if possible. Why is it then, John White, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
This sounds like a great plan. I mean, it's been proposed many times, but it's been boycotted by the U.S. and naturally, of course, by Israel. It's something that Iran would like to pursue. Why is this not being received positively and warmly?
Because neither the West or Israel are interested in peace and stability. They're interested in power and domination. And that's a great lacuna in all these negotiations. This is not about arriving at a place of peace and stability to replace the instability and the conflict that has been waged in that region over decades. It's about maintaining this power and balance that Israel enjoys because it has nuclear weapons and Iran does not have nuclear weapons. And that's what this is all about. And in many respects, these negotiations have been a charade.
Okay, unfortunately, we lost John White. We do apologize for that. So, Daniel Lazar, here we are. We are on the brink of perhaps a deal or not. And at this point, if we take a look at the way that things are moving forward with the new Iranian administration and the way that the U.S. is reacting, it's still up in the air whether this is going to happen or not. What is your take, if you can briefly tell us, as to where this is going to be going and then what's going to happen in turn if there is not going to be a nuclear deal?
I mean, I'm very pessimistic. I don't see any option for a nuclear deal. I've been pessimistic from the start. I mean, when Joe Biden announced in I think it was July 2020, that he wanted to re-enter the JCPOA, he attached to it conditions that Iran could not possibly meet, and conditions that were completely extraneous to the logic of the agreement. They dealt with non-nuclear issues like support for Hezbollah, Iran's own non-nuclear ballistic missile program, etc. And of course, Biden accused Iran of fostering terrorism, which is an absolute outrage. He also accused Iran of violating human rights, and obviously Iran is not guilt-free in that regard, but it ignores the massive violations on the part of Israel and Saudi Arabia, America's two major partners in the region. I can't see any way by which the JCPOA will be reactivated during a Biden administration. And if it's not reactivated, then I think that Israel's strategy, with backing from the U.S., is to place Iran at the disadvantage, to ratchet up the pressure steadily. And if Iran tries to increase its nuclear refinement processes, I think that Israel may very well respond with a major military strike.
Okay, we're gonna.
And I'm sorry. That's what I think this is all leading to.
No problem. Thank you. We're just fresh out of time. I want to thank you, though. That's Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, talking to us from New York. Many thanks. Also, thank writer you. And political analyst John White, thank you, who spoke to us from Edinburgh. And we had our correspondent, Homa Leski, who spoke to us from Vienna. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Itawi, it's goodbye. Until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. European citizens who have applied for settled status in Britain are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from UK ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. We'll prepare for you an article written by Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled Brexit Rules Force Families to Split. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. A British woman has told how she had to separate her six-year-old son from his French father because post-Brexit rules prohibited her spouse from returning with her to the United Kingdom for a new job without prior Home Office approval. After 11 years in France, the couple, who work in highly skilled jobs in the defence industry, decided to move back to the United Kingdom and thought it would be as simple as getting on a Eurostar train. However, the Home Office no longer recognises the European Union family permit her husband used before Brexit, and is now taking months to respond to applications for a British version. The delays are splitting countless families, whereby one British parent can return to the United Kingdom and a non-British one, whether an EU citizen or from elsewhere, cannot. The woman explained how she had little choice but to make the journey with her six-year-old son because her new job started on 6th of September, and although she was expecting a family permit for her husband within 15 days, 2 months after her application, she is still waiting for a Home Office response. She was so anxious that her dual national son might be refused entry because he has yet to get his British passport that she went so far as drilling him to say he was going on holiday if questioned by immigration officials. She sent her luggage on separately to make it look like she was not moving country. She said, "I was so scared that they would say, 'It seems to me like you are moving. No, sorry, your son cannot come,'" adding, "My husband stayed driving around Gare du Nord station in Paris just in case." She said, "I got so paranoid that I sent my baggage ahead on a service run by Eurostar and bought a return ticket because I had read that border officials were refusing people if they suspected your intention was to stay in Britain. It was so stressful, so awful, because we were afraid my son was going to be turned away." She added, "To be honest, it's very hard on my son. We tried to make light of it, just saying we're going on vacation, but he misses his father. Now he's saying, 'I miss my dad. When can we see dad?' She also feels bad for her husband, who also quit his job in anticipation of the move back to London. An aeronautical operations manager in the defense industry, he is now unemployed and may not be able to accept a new post in the United Kingdom while his application for a family permit is in progress. Non-EU and now non-British spouses have to rely on a 1992 EU legal precedent known as the Surinder Singh route to live in the United Kingdom. The government pledged that anyone returning to the United Kingdom from the European Union who was exercising their free movement rights could come back with a foreign spouse under this precedent. However, before a spouse can make his application to remain in the country, he must first be issued with a family permit. Alexander Finch, a manager at immigration specialist law firm Fragelman, said, "Overall, the European Union settlement scheme has worked well for many Europeans, but it's a shame that it is taking a very long time for Surinder Singh applicants. The withdrawal agreement requires the United Kingdom to deal with family permit applications on the basis of an accelerated procedure, which is not happening." He added that the United Kingdom is also going beyond previous requirements to prove that the place of residence was genuinely the European Union. He noted it doesn't help that the Home Office chose to go beyond the requirements of European Union law and has ended up with a confusing definition of genuine residence. According to government information, with reports of the Home Office in some cases taking 6 months to issue permits that are supposed to take just 15 days, Smith and her husband have joined a mounting number of parents facing potential splits. One young Briton in Portugal who is married to a Brazilian has told how she fears the delays in seeking a family permit could force her to temporarily leave her two-month-old baby with his father while she returns home to Bristol to get their four-year-old in school and start a new life. A Home Office spokesperson said, "Applications for the European Union settled status family permits are considered in strict date of application order, and we continue to review staffing levels and deploy resources to areas of greatest need. Each case is considered as quickly as possible and on its individual merits, but processing times can vary depending on the volume and complexity of applications. The 15-day service standard does not apply to all entry clearance applications." Meanwhile, European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from UK ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions even though they could prove they had applied for settled status, which should protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by the 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour that agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of the Immigration Enforcement raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge receipt of settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a response is received from the Home Office by the end of this week, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Recently, an EU citizen whom the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made a European Union settled status application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the EU national, who requested anonymity, told The Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives, and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." Pierre McClough, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain EU nationals, perhaps believing that they're easy to remove, but in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures." Pierre McClough added, "Whether this is due to administrative or willful neglect may be unclear, but by ignoring the legal steps the EU nationals have undertaken to assert their rights, the United Kingdom is in breach of its duties under the Brexit withdrawal agreement." The issue appears to relate mostly to applicants sent by post instead of forwarded digitally. Aranea Kogulathos, a barrister and legal manager of BID's European Economic Area project, said paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison, who found it difficult to access a computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 prison inmates at Wandsworth Prison, South London, almost 500 are believed to be EU nationals. Kogulathos said, despite having made European Union settled status applications, the European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation.